All right, so moving away from Raban, we then move to the Inheritor from him. And we have to talk about Geaty Prime and this whole thing. I have such a different sort of reaction to this. So I'd love for you guys to start the conversation on Geaty Prime. And then I will come in after the fact. I don't know how else to do this, but I have a very, I think, unique perspective on Geaty Prime.
Crossland's colorblind joke. Yeah.
It's not a colorblind. There's no joke here, man. We'll get into it when we get into it. But talk about the characters, talk about the moments, talk about things, and then we can kind of try to proceed. Because I can't think about it without like having a like revelation of a moment in my whole life.
Making a joke.
Yeah.
But you're colorblind. You
didn't know because I haven't talked about it. But yeah, you're not wrong. That's a part of it.
So we got Geaty Prime in the first book, and this felt so much more complete, I guess. This instance felt like a truly different planet compared to the previous one, which was just like, oh yeah, like we're. They say we're on a different planet, so I'll believe we're on a different planet. But this actually had tangible, like, visual differences. And, like, this world works differently than what we've seen previously, which I appreciate.
Yeah, the fact that they've, like, tamed a sun is nuts, basically, to, like, invert it in, like, the color perspective. Like, just from, like, a meta thing, right? Like, they have literally exerted their brutal control in such a way that they've inverted this star, and the way that impacts like everything that they do is just wild.
And I have no understanding of how any of it actually works.
Me neither.
Outside seems to be not like, I'm sure this is what you're getting into, but outside doesn't quite work like strict black and white, but inside of their like buildings and things looks like grayscale and sort of monotone in construction, but not like, but still like color, you know?
So. Yeah, totally. Tim, before I go off.
Yeah. I'm excited for that. I wonder if your reaction is going to be opposite from when we watched the colorized World War One movie.
Interesting.
Right?
Yeah, spoiler alert, it is.
Yeah. So I thought it was really cool. I would love, so we had always seen Geaty Prime at like the nighttime or whatever, when the sun is not like directly shining on the surface of the planet, right? And all that good stuff. So it's like really cool to see it now in this moment. And also too, their fireworks are like ink blots. It's like really cool. Yeah. Wow. What should I say? When I saw, so I've been watching Masters of the Air, and so I was on like episode 6 or something. And then when I saw Austin Butler, who plays a pilot in that and also is Elvis, and I was like, what the fuck? Because I'm a, you know, team no hyper. I didn't actually even catch that it was him in the like first movie after credit scene or whatever it is. So when I was like, what the dude, Elvis looks fucking crazy right now. That was like really cool to see our boy Vladimir Harkonnen and the, you know, scheming and game within game kind of stuff. That was really, really cool. One thing that's really cool from the infrared filming of the actual like scene. So they used infrared cameras for that. It is not a filter. It is not special effects. No. And even Denis Villeneuve said that it was a really, really hard decision to convince the studio to let them do that. Because once you dedicated to using infrared camera sensors, there was fucking no way to put the color back. Like, you could not colorize that footage. You could not do anything with it.
No, you couldn't.
Yeah, with the last thing I'll say, we should probably talk about, like, the character plays and moments there, but we should, or like right now we're kind of
we'll definitely talk about characters. Yeah. I definitely want to get to characters, so we can hold characters for a moment.
So I would just say it was really cool, mesmerizing, and I really loved it. Did not expect it, loved it.
I'm glad that you guys remember mesmerized, because I was past the point of mesmerized. This is brilliantly, I've talked a lot to you guys at the very least, and I maybe need to explain this a little bit more to listeners. I've talked about it before in the show. I'm black, white, gray color. I'm monochromatically colorblind. I have achromatopsia, monochromacy, been born with it, had it my whole life. I see in black, white, and gray. I can tell you what colors are because of the shade of gray. I could not tell you a single fucking color in the screen. I had an out-of-body experience as the color faded from Stellan Skarsgård's face as he approached the screen. Generally speaking, the way that colorization works for me as I view something is I see the colors as they are, and then I see a filter be applied, a tone applied, and something shifting them away from natural tones as I understand them, and then they invert back into those same tones. So it's like we're basically crisscrossing on a scale until like reality resumes, right? Like you mentioned, the Peter Jackson colorized World War II, World War I stuff didn't work because it was oversaturated in different ways for me, and it gave me kind of a headache. But I appreciated it nonetheless because like the colors were wrong, but it was like cool, and they were trying for me at the very least. This was the only time in my entire life that I've ever seen something that was black, white, and gray. It freaked me out. It shook me to my core. It fundamentally, I shiver even thinking about it. I just, Fade coming out in this black and white thing, the blade on the tongue, all of these different moves, the fight scene. I cried in the theater watching this happen because it was so wild and weird. It was a different experience than any that I've ever had watching anything ever. And cheers to Denny for like being crazy enough to do the infrared thing. There are only 20,000 other people with the identical condition that I have in the United States. So I hope they all go fucking see this movie because it was a wild experience. Yeah.
I was gonna ask, is it a good or bad experience? Sounds like good.
Oh, so good. It was so cool. It was so different. And now like I kind of feel like I get the like shift to black thing, but maybe the other side of this is maybe it's overplayed for you, but it's not for me. So for me, this was so grandiose and so perfect. And then you get like the crazy inverted fireworks, and I'm like, is that occasionally how it, but it doesn't. It never looks that way. It never appears because of the way that infrared captures versus regular.
What did you mean shift to black?
Shift to black?
Yeah, you said shift to black. You said it's not like the shift to black thing. What is the shift to black thing?
So if you generally just like apply a black white filter to something, right, versus capturing on something like infrared.
I see. Okay.
The difference therein is obviously you're preserving gradients versus infrared is not by any stretch.
So Crossland, I am curious because I remember like we've talked about this at length throughout our lives in general. Yeah. Like I remember the first time you and I watched a movie together that had a black and white scene where like,
yeah, we did the Wizard of Oz, right? That's always my fun party trick.
Yeah. That's the fun one. But I like remember having conversations with you and like seeing different films where like, there's a difference between black and white in polarization versus non-polarization, where like that.
This is past that. This is
different than that.
This is gone. This is color gone, which is wild.
Okay. So I could tell that there was something fucked up about it. I didn't realize that it was
infrared,
a different sensor in general, or a different like means of capturing the image. But I did recognize that it wasn't just black and white. There was something completely different about it. I think a part of the reason why it didn't come across to me as like infrared is because of the teeth and like infrared or night vision, like footage in general really, really shines like white teeth. And a lot of the people, like Fade specifically, has black teeth.
Mm-hmm. They painted black, I'm sure, to avoid that. Yeah,
right. So it doesn't come across as this like very clearly.
You want a cross comparison inside of that moment?
Yeah.
The box that Fenring is in is inverted colors, not infrared. Everything else, for the most part, is infrared. Fenring's box is not infrared. You can tell by the way that her teeth are colored because they have black streaks as though it's inverted with a black light.
Okay.
Because the way that they filmed it. And that was an interesting transition for me in that scene where it's like we cut to the box a couple of times and I'm like, bah. And I got like basically hit by like a wave and it was like a partial lighting. And I was like, okay, that's kind of similar to the way that they like transitioned in. But then I was like, versus the rest of it like worked. But again, this is a specific me thing. This isn't a wider consumption thing. A moment that I had.
I don't mean to poke a joke at you, but it is funny where I'm imagining you saying you're having like a literal out of body experience, and then you're just like for like 2 seconds, like
Yeah, it's kind of a jump scare. Yeah, yeah. Like a color jump scare. But yeah,
no, that's
PJ. You're totally right, though. Yeah,
that's pretty cool.
On the whole, yeah, it was wild. I explained it to my dad because I was trying to like get him to come because I could be like, I want to see color. You could get it for once. Like, you know, shared experience. But yeah, I digress. Giddy Prime is cool as shit. We should talk about the characters, though. This is just all the film shit. Emotionally, it's hard for me to move. It's weird. It's
DJ
weird.
Doesn't know what we're going to be talking about. Yeah.
So let's talk about a little bit about the setup of the duel and Fade's introduction on the whole. This Fade is different than I imagined and better in every way. It fits the movie sort of portrayal of the visceral, brutal nature much better than Sting ever could have or would have. But it's so interestingly rendered from a choice of Austin Butler, from like the bold portrayal in general, as opposed to the red hair, you know, kind of every small detail that's accumulated for the family and for the POV.
Yeah, my impression of Fade's character was kind of that he was, you know, we've mentioned Red Rising before, but it's kind of like the Darrow Cassius, the like same person, but peer, or like it's your peer enemy. But like, well, clearly he's not an animal because he did pass the Gom-Jabbar test, but there is much more like raw in this portrayal of Fade Ralpha, and I love it. It's so good. So yeah, that's no notes. Once again, Denny, good job.
Austin Butler dissolved into this character.
Yeah.
Oh my God. And he also absorbed Stone Skarsgård's accent, which I think was funny. I didn't expect him to like mirror the same like speech pattern.
I will say it was a little weird sometimes when at one point he had like a southern drawl, like the Elvis voice. And then other times he sounded a bit like Vladimir / Stellan. And I was like, that's a little weird, but it was fine. Cause it's like this character's a little fucky.
He's fucked to begin with.
I feel like there's a whole lot missing about this character. Like I feel like I want to understand more about him, and I was expecting him to survive this story. Yeah. Like so I could learn more of his backstory and more about it, which made him dying in that duel at the end of this film truly like unexpected for me.
Yeah, what a testament to the story that a third act villain introduced has so much weight and then is just gone. Like,
yeah,
damn.
Mm-hmm.
Convincingly and like really, really well done.
Yeah, the like maybe if you analyze this whole thing versus like the core text, maybe the one singular shortcoming that I might point to from an adaptation perspective is that we chose Raban over Fade to give some of the moments and scenes. Some of that's casting, some of that's timing. But Fade doesn't play necessarily a more prominent side in the story, but in an adaptation, you can give him a little bit more prominence. So I would have, if I were so cool, but I'm not, I would have leaned in a little bit sooner on Fade. I wouldn't have introduced him in part one instead of maybe like a stinger, you know, intro. But yeah. I again don't fault it. This is as near a perfect movie as we can get, as mentioned previously. So,
as a minor complaint, I feel like the Bene Gesserit's opinion of Fade really, really just kind of distilled down to a psychotic guy. Short, I guess it felt empty a little bit, and I felt like it could have been like. Their perception of him could have been a little bit deeper. He's psychotic.
That's interesting.
Oh no! It didn't. I think they could have been
that's
a
interesting.
Little bit more descriptive of who this character truly is.
Yeah,
like, even sadistic might have been like a better choice of descriptor.
I would agree. I think that they used the term psychotic a couple too many times. Peeling in other adjectives even would have reiterated it to some different degree. Sadistic he is, obviously, in his behavior, as well as a bit of a masochist in the way that he enjoys kind of watching it from the outside. So he's got those like confluences of things. from a character perspective. Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think that it was reductive, though, from the Bene Gesserit side, because they're looking at him as a chess piece. They look at everyone like a chess piece.
That's fair.
And that's what we haven't actually talked about this at all in this episode yet on the whole. So maybe this is a good point to segue and then kind of come back to like exit Fade from this early perspective. We have Princess Irulan introduced and the Emperor, as well as we get a lot more Reverend Mother throughout this movie. It's maybe collectively somewhere between like 7 and 10 minutes, you know, of perspective that we get. Basically, Irulan divides the parts of the movie or the acts of the movie with a log, which is pretty much how the book goes with each chapter heading.
It's really cool.
And so it was kind of neat that like you kind of get the same thing, but with like act breaks almost in the movie. I'm curious on your guys' thoughts on the princess, the emperor, the Bene Gesserit, and sort of the overall plot up until what we're talking about now, because we didn't talk about it.
The actors that play the princess and the Bene Gesserit agent that seduces Fade looked so similar that I truly thought it was the princess.
You mistook Florence Pugh for Lea Seydoux. You weren't the only one. My friend that came with me today also made the same error. So
I didn't realize it until going through the Wikipedia article to write the breakdown of this story. Like,
you didn't even realize in the second watch?
No.
They look so different.
No, it didn't.
They're also in the same scene together twice.
I didn't pick up on it. Like I thought that we were going to get into a situation where Paul was married to a woman who was carrying Fade's child.
Complex. That's an extra layer of complexity that would have been interesting. I think to like solve your problem, PJ, all we had to do to like also bring forward maybe the Harkonnen traits that aren't present. You know, they're all baldies for the most part. They were redheads in the book. And so you make Fenring a redhead and like that would equate it or like divest us, I think, enough and like bring in a little something.
Yeah, I don't know why I didn't catch it that way, but yeah. Even the second watch through didn't really kind of fuck me up.
Yeah. Okay. How about Christopher Walken as the Emperor?
Yeah, I was really nervous for that. Or not so, he's done like very serious roles like Boardwalk Empire and et cetera, but like actually there's a cut of this, but I always the role that I always go to or see him in my head is it Balls of Fury, the ping pong comedy. Somebody has edited him into as that character into Dune.
Oh no.
And it's really fucking funny, but that is the role I mostly see him in. I've seen people say things like he didn't look very like emperorly. And like, I'm so against that opinion because it's like, yes, his clothes don't look so opulent and they don't really match like what the book had. I actually don't remember what the book had, but like he's an emperor through his actions and through like his like entourage and like his power that he demonstrates. Like this motherfucker took a planet down or like a spaceship that looks like a planet down into another planet and like set up his army there. Like this guy has power. He does a great job. His like, he didn't like play up his accent, which that sounds like a weird, almost like rude thing to say.
He's
but
got
he didn't
tone or a pacing.
Right. And he
to the way that he
modified fakes. To be the character. And it was, I thought he was a great emperor and I loved his like unkempt old emperor who's been through some shit hair. I got a lot to deal with and I like it. So
darling daughter. Yeah.
Yeah.
I personally loved it. I had no problems with it. I thought that it was great. Someone, as we were leaving the theater, said, why didn't we make Bill Murray the Emperor? I was like, sure. But no, it's not just like any old actor. Walken has like a good fucking repertoire beneath him and has always been like a great dramatic actor in addition to the occasional comedy actor. And like the accent he puts on to emphasize, or like the pacing he puts on to emphasize. That's not how he speaks in everything. It's just generally how he speaks. But then if he has to act differently, he does. And he does that in a number of other movies. And it's just so funny that like he's just become so known for that, that people didn't expect a good performance out of him. And it's like, well, Christ, he did great. It was great. I just wish he had more, in all honesty. Like, that's the just my thing in general with this movie, is I mm-hmm. could have gone again for like another 30 minutes without a problem.
I think some of people's concerns are kind of valid, in the sense that, like, so I just checked, he's from Queens. I actually thought he was from Boston, but like, it's the same kind of, I don't mean to pick out these people like this, but Bill Burr in Mandalorian is just like, it's fourth wall breaking for me, which I love Bill Burr so much, but like, suddenly there is a guy from Boston in space in a like different galaxy, right? Like, it's, how is this guy from Boston mm-hmm. here? And I think people sometimes get that same thing with Christopher Walken, but I thought he did an amazing job, and I loved him as the Emperor. Also, on the Princess Irulan bit, when they first introed her and she's holding her little like microphone and she's got her like voice recording box mm-hmm. and she's like,
comment three, Stardate 1071,
just like a chapter heading. I was like, dude, mm-hmm. Dennis, she's doing it.
Dennis the dude. Yeah.
Yeah.
PJ, how do you feel about the Emperor and the Princess?
I had no pretense.
Did you care?
Yeah. I like Christopher Walken in general, and was happy to see him in a serious role like this. I thought he did a great job.
Yeah.
I do not know the actress.
Florence Pugh? You've seen Florence Pugh so many things.
Maybe. She's Oppenheimer's love affair or whatever.
Yep. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I've seen her in. So,
yep, good point. Yeah.
That can't be the only thing you've seen her in.
The only thing know of that I've seen her in.
Maybe you, Tim. I'll give you the out. PJ has seen at least one of these movies that I'm staring at.
All right, what movies?
Midsommar?
Nope.
I've seen that. She's in that?
Okay, well, yeah, she is very actively in that movie.
Oh, okay.
Little Women?
Nope.
Hmm. Black Widow, which neither of you have seen. Yeah. I'm giving you the out there mostly. Thing that I'm thinking of, she was in a couple shows. Okay, fine. I'll give you the out. I guess I've seen, I'm staring at this list. There are 20 movies. I've seen 13 of them. Yeah. Don't Worry, Darling. Puss in Boots, The Last Wish. Outlaw King.
Don't Worry, Darling.
Okay, there you go. Yeah. She plays the lead.
Yep. Yep, she does.
although, to be fair, you do constantly claim that you have bad actor recall. All right, to get back on the point.
Actor recall.
Yeah. What actor?
To get back.
What did you think of the actors that weren't in the scenes on Getty Prime? Crossland.
Oh God, the biggest, I don't want to say the biggest sin, there's no like serious sin,
there's no sin.
I feel very bad about the fact that Tim Blake Nelson was cut as Lord Fenring, because what I wouldn't have given to see that character, in addition to the other big miss collectively in what feels like the story, and this is maybe like an end thing to talk about, but Hufar Thawit missing out inside of the story, and like in general, the Mentats are like the big losers from an adaptation perspective. So yeah, but I specifically the Fenrings, I'm shocked that Lady Fenring was included. That feels like out of all of the things to include, the weirdest one, the most interesting one, an interesting choice. It plays into a longer game than what Denny is committing to, which is fascinating, because like that really doesn't like, I'm trying not to spoil too hard, but like we kind of skip Messiah with that plot line a little bit. So we'll see in Children of Dune kind of a thing. But to like not skip that and to like include that as an important note is an interesting choice from an IP perspective, especially as he only wants to do Messiah. He doesn't want to continue after that. So
PJ too. So Count Fenring is Margot Fenring's husband. Margot Fenring's the one who dominatrix is Fade, the Bene Gesserit woman. So Count Fenring is like a good friend of Vladimir Harkonnen and is like his advisor, like his like hand of the king kind of thing, that wouldn't be occupied by Piter, who is the Mentat, but also Piter's dead. So Baron Harkonnen puts more emphasis on confederating. And so like they do like some scheming and plotting, and like he's involved in the book earlier than this fight scene that's on Getty Prime, because he's the like advisor to Baron Harkonnen. And he's like he's a really cool character. And I don't know if you remember who Tim Blake Nelson is, but that's like the guy who plays Discount Rorschach in Watchmen.
Watchmen.
And he's like,
we said this very differently.
Oh, brother, where art thou? Yeah. And he had a role. He had scenes in this movie and they were cut. I'm applying malice when I say that sentence, but like, I get why they cut it, but that is so disappointing, because to see him as like a bouffant count and court master, and we've seen him in Buster Scruggs and like as Discount Rorschach and like all these different things, so like, man, that character, like that actor has so much range, and to do this role and then to play that role alongside the Banff who played Thufir Hawat scheming together, god, that would have been so fucking cool. But we didn't get to see it, because one layer from the fight scene that fades in that we don't see, we do see the two knives, but the way the knives are set up is the short knife is poisoned and the big knife isn't. But in the actual fight, he actually did a little switcheroo on the knives, and that was like part of their scheming with like Count Fenring and Thufir Hawat and like the drugging and not drugging. There's like a huge thing going on in that match in the background, and we don't get any of it. Ultimately fine, but it's just like, man, like, so I was gonna say this at the end, but just like how we're making these comparisons to Lord of the Rings and how there's like the extended editions, and there's people who will be like, okay, once a year I'm gonna spend 17 hours and I'm gonna sit and watch all Lord of the Rings. Denis Villeneuve is known to not like extended editions and director's cuts and all that stuff. Like, there's his, like, I've heard there's a 5-hour cut of Blade Runner 2049. He does not like to do long cuts or like extended editions.
The movie is the movie. It's the art. It's what it is.
God, what do we have to do to get release
that, just those scenes?
The Villeneuve cut.
Yeah.
So, please.
Give me that 12 minutes or whatever it was.
That actually makes something that, like, I didn't realize bothered me. It doesn't bother me, but when Fade is sort of examining the knives before, he mentions how the tip should be sharper, but it felt like he was doing more than that. When he
part of why he's licking it, because he's like, it should be poisoned, and like, it's not, and he's like kind of proving it in a way, which is again the sort of like perverse thing for him.
Okay. But going backwards a little bit, this count that
Count
is
Fenring.
So close to the Baron and is married to the person that seduces Fade.
Oh yeah.
In the book, does Fade understand that relationship and know the person?
Oh yeah.
Know this.
Yeah, but she's using the voice.
Okay.
He's all for it. Here, I think he even proposes it.
Yeah. An unknown guest in the house.
Yeah.
Okay.
Offline, I mentioned something that's from Hunters and Sandworms, Tim. I don't know how much you know about like the longer lore of like the sort of exclusion of the Fenrings.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's played up in Children to begin with. I think that's when that's planted. I mentioned it to PJ of like, that's one of the most fascinating things, is that they are outside of the scope of like vision. And that becomes a thing in the last two books, and is never like finished as a plot line. But the fact that people are outside of the scope of this, like this vision of humanity, and the Fenrings are at the heart of that, is such also like a meta fascinating point, which is why I found just the inclusion of the name Fenring in general here to be so interesting to, like, again, forward thinking from a serious perspective, because if there's anything to cut in my mind, the Fenrings can go, and you can like make this scene with like literally anyone else. You don't need to use, you can use the name like homage or whatever, but like doing it this way worked great in both camps.
Yes. So, but also we did not get to see Tim Blake Nelson in Dune Part 2.
I know. Like, I want it.
Which is
actually
like so disappointing.
I love Tim Blake Nelson.
Yeah, he's great.
He's so good. Yeah. The only... Yeah.
And we didn't get to see Thufir Hawat, which basically Thufir Hawat ends up working for the Harkonnens, but kind of like long tail, what information can I gather about how they're working and whatnot, and then eventually return to Paul should he not be dead. Kind of like a position of circumstance that he finds himself in. But like, it really kind of doesn't matter, but it's so cool. Thufir Hawat, he's cool. He's a human computer, man.
Great.
Anyways.
Yeah. And this, Dennis has been very clear about the fact that this is a like Bene Gesserit version of the story to some degree. Like, it's focusing on that side. And that's great. I just kind of miss the sort of thing where it's like Paul is like a mentat almost in training side of the story. But that's neither here nor there. We've spent a lot of time talking about this component. It wraps up a number of things. Did you guys have any other thoughts on like Fade Rotha, the duel, the sequence therein, ending most of the line of Atreides? I have nothing more to add outside of this was one of the coolest scenes I've seen in my entire fucking life because of the way that it was filmed. So, you know, that was a uniquely incredible moment, and I'm not sure that it will ever be replicated in anything that I ever watch ever again. So that's why this movie will forever live in my top five, regardless, because it gave me something that nothing else has ever done, ever. So good on you, Greg Fraser, and Denny for taking the risk on infrared.
I don't think I have anything additional. I felt like being a sequel, I mean, this is stretching for a complaint, and I don't actually feel like this was a bad thing the way that it was done. But if we had been introduced more like directly introduced to the person that ended up being the undrugged fighter in the first film, I feel like that would have been more meaningful.
Here's a good segue. What if it was Gurney Halleck? But we do see him back on Arrakis. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Ta-da!
Specifically, what I was thinking was if this was Gurney, it would have been a really, really powerful.
Unfortunately, Gurney is so much more important to the larger story, so we can't get rid of him yet, but I appreciate the idea. But that said, like, yeah, we could have included like a minor guard member or something like that that was like around, you know, a lot to like make that a family thing. But there's 73 million members of House Atreides. So there are so many people that are House Atreides specifically. So this is just like a random Joe kind of is sort of the thought. Mm-hmm. It's more of like a fief or like a title of land than it is like necessarily a genetic name at a certain point in the way that the sort of kingdoms work. So he is kind of a nobody, and that's kind of the intent. This is sort of an execution of a nobody and the end of a thing.
We don't understand the spread of the name of the House Atreides. Like, it didn't feel that big.
By counter, that's kind of the point, is that it shouldn't... They're playing it up to be something bigger than it is. But I think the text is actually giving you the expectation. Like, okay. I think it's delivering on that, because it's not supposed to be that big of a deal, but Harkonnen's making it a big deal. These are a bunch of nobodies, you know? But they're House Atreides, so it seems like a big deal, because they're the last of them. But they're nobody. That said, like, I get your point. Like, it doesn't feel like an impactful moment. It's not meant to be.
Not that it doesn't feel impactful, but I think there could, if it was constructed with both films produced at the exact same time, you could, I think they would have made it more impactful by including that character in the first film.
Yeah, I get that. I just don't know if it's better that way. Does that make sense? Like, I think...
I don't know if it's better either. I'm just... This is the tiniest of nitpick that I don't actually give a shit about.
No, I know. And I'm, you know, just going to speak into my thoughts on the meta. Mm-hmm. All told, you know, nothing seriously wrong with that opinion. And again, tiniest of nitpicks. But I can't help but think that, like, making it a more immediate character is a little bit worse. What's fun, PJ, fun fact about the guy that plays the one Atreides that does fight back. He's the fight coordinator for all of the action sequences. Hmm. He is the guy. And so they put him in to do that sequence.
That's pretty fun.
Specifically. So he is, you know, the final Atreides. So yeah, he was a part of the first movie and the second movie secretly. So there's your bonus fact. Tim's all shaking his head. All right. So let's move back to Arrakis here, as Tim had mentioned, and make it to Gurney Halleck. We see this sort of rogue moment for him as he has stolen one of the older spicing harvesters to run his rogue operation with a number of others. We open him playing a, I believe, 12 string. It's like a 10 string guitar. I thought it was 12. I counted.
Excuse me. He's 10. Playing a fucking balisette, you dork.
No, it is a balisette, but it is. They use the body of a 12 string, but they didn't put the right number of strings.
Yeah.
It's a you're balance right, set. But also he wasn't doing the whole thing. Anyway,
I like the mini. I keep mentioning like mini adaptation things, and like this is one of them where like in the book he plays a balisette at one point to like some Fremen because they're like, oh, we heard you're good at playing the balisette. Can you play the balisette? And he like does, and he sings, and it's cool. This movie doesn't have time to do like an intimate scene like that. So like to open with him just like chilling. I should stay by the mic to open with him just kind of like sitting in the back of the little like plane thing and hitting some strings on the old balisette. Like, oh, it's so good. Mini adaptation things. I love it. So his character overall was really cool. And the whole way that entire scene played out was really cool. I liked his like really shitty, but clearly not Harkonnen, like industrial still suit / hazardous environment suit. His lasgun was really freaking cool too. Actually, I'm not sure if it was a lasgun or like some sort of like slug gun, but yeah, it was really cool. So I like it. Good to see some mines. Really good scene.
The mine thing was wild. I didn't anticipate that at all. And so the like, there was almost like a horror moment of like, what the fuck is happening? Also, you're like, you're rooting for Gurney to live here, but you clearly know that it's the Fremen striking out. And so you're like, wait, which side am I on? And again,
yeah,
it's a there's no sides.
You're worried at some point, like what happens if they don't stop in time or like they don't like the wrong person gets to Gurney. Fortunately, the right person does, because I know your footsteps, old man.
I can hear your footsteps. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really cool. And that's a callback to like a movie one, right? So
movie several one, there are a couple. One. Go ahead.
I said several times through movie one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, right away in the beginning of this movie, there's a callback that Gurney says, which is, Paul, stop turning your back to like what's going on, behind you. And oh, man, is that not foreshadowing for everything that is to come? Yeah, by and large. But Gurney's reintroduction here, I think, is seamless. PJ, how do you feel about Gurney, the sort of scene with this harvester?
So just in general, First and foremost, the biggest piece of the set is this harvester, which is starkly different from all of the other harvesters that we're dealing with.
It's not that crazy from the part one harvesters. It's pretty similar.
It's the same
to that
as the,
one.
As the yeah, part one harvesters, but it is completely different from all of the Harkonnen harvesters.
Got it. Yeah. I was like, pretty much the same. There was a small difference, and I'll just...
Yeah,
go for it. Micro difference that I noticed watching them back to back is that the cabin where the driver is shifted. It's center in part one and it's on the right in part two. It's the smallest thing, but it was one of those micro details that was like, ooh, that's actually wrong a little bit. Or it's different. It's just different. And I'm so cool with accepting that it's a slightly different model. But nonetheless.
But
it's got the same balloon deployment. It's got the same.
Yeah. But it did prime me right away to be like, oh, this is not the like state of the art Harkonnen. So like Gurney.
Right. You know, it's a
not,
different person,
like,
but who?
Yeah.
Right?
Well, like, we open with Gurney singing and like playing the.
Yeah. Like, what's he doing here? Yeah.
Or not guitar.
You said it right.
Good job.
So, but that primed me to not believe that he was working for the Harkonnens, but rather that this was a separate operation, which it ended up being correct. But I don't know if we hadn't had the conversation in the first episode, our first Dune breakdown, talking about the difference in spice harvesters, I don't think I would have picked up on that.
Fair. I think the thing that makes it visually obvious is the, this one reaches out with, three prongs and only has, three prongs going really slowly, versus the Harkonnen one has, 20, 24, some multiplicative number that is just prepping more and, pulling more, it seems, on an 8 basis. But, yeah, I guess
otherwise. Also, the giant fucking bulbous thing on the top of them.
Yeah, the bulbous also, I'm totally neglecting the fact that it has legs. The legs matter, Yeah. Also, are the legs meant to distract worms? Why do we got? I mean, I don't want to question a sci-fi design, but obviously it's to support the bulbous nature of everything up top. But, why are we crawling like a spider? Cool. I really loved Grinny's reintroduction. I was a little skeptical of him coming back in the way that they had portrayed the story, but it was great. Grinny joins the group, of course. We get a little bit of him acclimating. There's a wonderful comedic moment when he tries to fill up a tent and the tent farts effectively as he fails. And Johnny's like, he's a waste of water, which is, whoa, what an insult.
Good part to insert that in the book, they call the tent door the sphincter door.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I'm drunk, so I need to say that.
Crawl through the sphincter door.
Yes. Yeah. You said it farted, so I.
Yeah, yeah. Then. I mean, fair enough. The sphincter gave loose a cloud of all right. Whatever the hell.
Yep, that's you. You got
mm-hmm,
it.
Mm-hmm. It's great. This is what people expect. This is what people are here for. Oh, God.
Help.
Then, in the end, we do arrive with Gurney Halleck at the nuclear arsenal, as Paul has been wrestling with sort of the legacy that he holds of the Atreides. He's the final remnant, kind of, not really, because Leia is about to exist and or exists in proxy, but he feels he's one of the last. And so there's something prominent on his shoulders. Gurney returning is just this big opening moment for him. But the nuclear arsenal is a moment in which we face down potential consequences of our decision to wage war, period.
Was a big shift in the impact possible by this Fremen force. Big, big, big shift. And he says it's enough to blow up the whole world, and kind of reels back on that a little bit. But I don't know how much
he's well, it was really a metaphor, but that.
Believable, I think.
Yeah, it's terrifying. I mean, we only see three, I think, launched in the end.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and those three do monumental damage to what is portrayed as a small area on Arrakis, but in reality, it is a much larger region than. The movie does a good job showing and kind of giving us a visual picture, map picture, but this is scarring Texas to some degree, if that makes sense, in what they did and the action that was taken.
Yeah, it's definitely a smaller scale here. Three nuclear warheads. It probably should have obliterated the size of the base that they had.
Yeah, again, that's why I'm saying the scale is a little warped. I wouldn't say off, but warped, because they obliterated a mountain range, and that's a big deal. That's not something you do lightly,
right?
Which gives rise to the worms that come. We aren't there yet, but the nuclear stockpile is very powerful. There's no doubt that it could nuke the world and kill them all multiple times over. But and again, reasons that those are held are because it's the only thing that keeps the families from blowing each other up is mutually assured destruction. And that's sort of the peace that's maintained between the houses as such. So We get to Fade becoming the leader of Arrakis, being appointed. He gets the nice little necklace put on him, those like heavy little chains, and they're black and they're cool and they're sick and very emo. And Fade immediately humiliates Raban inside of the room with all the other mentats that are managing sort of the spice production and the deployment of troops, kicking him onto the ground, making him kiss his boot while his blade is cutting into his neck and he's actively bleeding. Curious on your guys' portrayal here of what you think with Raban, but then in addition, the sort of follow-up motion with the attack on the Siege and the Fremen and kind of the way that that plays out.
So this is specifically what I was talking about, making Dave Bautista look meek somehow to presumably a much smaller actor sort of exerting power over him.
Yeah, I don't know how tall. Austin Butler's a solid
it's
six.
It's not just height.
So yeah.
It's not just height.
Height no, is not what matters in that matchup. Yeah.
No. You're not wrong. I'm not saying you were, but I was like, is he physically smaller? And I was like, I don't think he's that much smaller. But yeah, like obviously, like build, shoulders, everything else. He puts down his brother, basically, with technique as opposed to
the
muscle,
yeah,
which
the
is impressive
it too, right? The Baron's like, yeah, you embarrass us one more time and like you're dead or whatever he says, right?
Right.
Like, damn. Just getting real. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought that was good. Like, again, I just want to see more Saffron Morton, please. But his introduction and then what they then do to all of the different sieges is like wild, especially isn't this the scene too, or like following this scene when they're actually like attacking sieges? This is where you see Chaney with a nightmare of having like a post atomic used like burned face. And then,
yes.
And then you see, well, it's not her face that's been burned. It's like the siege. So it's like a metaphorical, like it's like, damn.
Yeah,
dude,
my
like,
people have been burned.
This
right.
Is, yeah, it's insane. It's really good. And it shows, again, like the conflict of like the choice of 1 billion dies to prevent 100 billion dying or whatever, right? That Paul keeps seeing, and the book and the movie are really good at showing like what that looks like. And Fade is like a good mechanism for revealing more of that plot.
Yeah, Fade is, in all honesty, here is where he shines the brightest. This decision to like go to the Siege and like see him take over in such an ineffective way shows him as this like potential rival Kwisatz Haderach, as the Bene Gesserit have made clear up until this point that he was supposed to be the sort of like secondary potential, as there were many, many actions or many plays in order.
It does make me wonder what other prophecies is Paul not fulfilling that Fade might be.
Mm. Ooh, spicy. Interesting. Fade's a fascinating character because he does feel similar to Paul in a lot of ways, even in his portrayal, but from like a very different uprising background, and the way that he's like come about power is fundamentally different, but on a long enough timeline, do they look similar? And I stretch towards the answer, yes. And that's, I think, also the answer that Herbert portrays in the text from like a power is an end eventually. So to your point, PJ, that I'm making for you, I guess. Yeah. Yeah. I think they're the same.
Mm.
Eventually. Tim, I think it makes sense for us to talk about one of the biggest divergences in the story here, which is kind of a tough one to like gauge the impact of. In the book, this is a very big moment in which obviously Chani and Paul have a child, and this is when Leto II dies in this siege. So Paul loses his child, and it kind of spurns him into a moment of, as opposed to Chani strictly being the motivation for him to go south, there is this other motivation in addition to being encouraged and like seeing the path of the future of survival and everything else that he does. Losing Leto breaks him fundamentally and sort of shatters that for him. And that's one of those things that I think the movie does a good job of portraying, like the way that impacts him and the people and like what needs to be done for the people, which gives it a better cultural perspective. But from a character-driven perspective, this is my number one biggest fault with the movie, kind of, is that this is sort of the weakest inflection point of many of Paul's decisions.
Okay. Yeah,
and maybe only compared because I have such a strong base. You know what I mean? Like, losing Leto the Second is such a good motivation that this just feels weaker, but that's, you know... I still really like the movie, obviously, but
I think
it's like my one.
Because they got rid of that, and because we don't see Paul thinking through this in the same way, like, we don't have the narrator providing us his thoughts in this moment.
Right.
That's like my biggest complaint of the movie is, I don't know if this is my biggest complaint, but it's the way that this all plays
out. Nature of adaptation. Yeah.
Well, you talked earlier and said earlier that, like, Chaney's character is like the audience's helper through this movie, right? Like, she's the one that helps us like see the difference between the fundamentalists and like the realist normal people who are just the like Fadaiken. She is the lens for the audience, but also her motivations are going to diverge from Paul's. And if you don't agree with her view of Paul's motivations and you're an audience member, you're like not going in the same direction she is, which is me, for example, because I'm team Lisa and Al-Kaib all the way. And so, like,
I think that breaks in the moment that he takes the water, right?
I just mention it now because this is like a falling action that, like, her character and Paul, like, kind of like have like a falling, not falling out, but the things start to unravel here. And if you're like, audience guide doesn't match with me as an audience member, then it's like, it feels weird, bad, not good.
PJ, how did you feel on the whole with the decision to go south?
It felt inevitable.
As one does that sees the future and sees inevitability. Yep.
Well, it felt like even from
it's kind
from
of the nature of the plot.
Yeah. Of like the entire time where he's trying to push against the idea of going south, I'm like, all right, he's going to have to go south. Like, it never felt like something that he could actually avoid doing.
Mm-hmm.
Even before
touches the nature of prophecy, you know, like that's the brutal part about like prophetic storytelling is you're like kind of trapped from a character perspective in that. And as a character trying to operate and they're like, I want to break the prophecy. It's like, God damn it. Every turn that I make, I'm called Mod Deep, and that's like the name of one of the many names of the prophet. And like, there are all these small things that like, I didn't realize would accumulate up until this point. It's very clear that I've been planted, or I am the thing. And it's just registering, you know, for everyone else's clock radar. All right. So Paul makes it south, follows his mother's path and drinks the water of life. More prophecy is fulfilled as he is awoken from his death by the tears of the desert spring, which is Chani's secret name, as we've learned inside of this movie, bringing him to life as the Kwisatz Haderach, the Lisan al-Ghaib, the many titles that we've ascribed to Paul's character here, and the awakening of his mind to a cognizant foresight and quasi-omniscience. How'd you feel about this moment on the whole? How do we feel?
Chani has this name.
Mm-hmm.
Is she ever told that like her name appears in a prophecy regarding Lisan al-Ghaib?
This is completely the movie. Right. There is no anything in the book. Correct me, Tim?
I don't think so, no.
Yeah.
Okay.
She is not involved in his revival in the book.
Gotcha. That's not true.
Outside of her being present, like the tear water of life thing is not there.
I think that's correct.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
She is there, but she is not like,
I think also too, Jessica's telling people that Paul's just been praying for the last month instead of like everyone's
in reality is like dying.
Basically dead body. Yeah. Yeah.
This takes a month in the book.
Something like that. Yeah.
All right.
Because it's basically like in that you don't get anything really in the book or in the movie, but I'm pretty sure he just has visions and like he's just tripping balls like
we do see visions, we just don't get like context.
Yeah,
which is, you know,
yeah, because yeah, after this he knows the way, like he sees all the different times and now like the path is clear.
Yes.
And he knows exactly what shit he's got to do. Yeah.
Yeah. He sees all.
Yeah, no, pretty standard scene. They drink vodka.
Pretty fucking normal. Yeah, it was just vodka. Yeah, as mentioned at the very top of this, the whole vodka replacement thing is just great. It's another moment of Rebecca Ferguson's superiority on a film set, as she is apparently just a gem and everyone loves her to death. Yeah, I mean, who doesn't love someone who brings vodka? She's playing, once again, a character from The First Law, Monza Mercato, my favorite character in Bester Cold. So, my favorite book. So, I'm so excited to get there and to talk about it more. But, like, it's so clear that she embodies the character even from this perspective. Ah, I can't wait. Can't wait. Can't wait. Can't wait. Cool. Nothing else in The Water of Life? Did we have any takes? I will say the one thing that's cool, we kind of skipped over this with the visit down, but the taming of the worm and the showing how the water of life is attained or got is another wonderful addition of the movie to this whole process, because it was not clear by any stretch. It was just like, yes, we drown a worm.
Yeah, I was curious there was no, if this like, process. Kills the worm or if there... If it
yeah, it kills
the
it.
Worm. I assumed so, but
yeah.
Is it the blood? Is it a secretion from some gland that only comes upon death?
Like, dude, you got to read two more books. I can't explain that one to you right now. Right. You gotta. I gotta. That is such a far answer than the moment right now, and right. Giving it to you would.
I want to say
getting to our audience that's listening to this. Yeah. It is the wrong question to answer of all of them.
Fair. Okay.
Unfortunately. So yeah. Cause Tim and I both likely have feelings about this, but I like the depiction. I appreciate the move.
Is it actually
I'm curious
piss?
Where it would go? It's not worm piss. I would call it closer to like a soul. But that's not accurate by any stretch.
That was mostly a joke based on earlier comment from.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the this is the only thing that like I think I'm gonna just skate by and try to not answer because
you can just
it's
not
two
answer
books
it.
From
okay.
now. It's not like if anyone listening to this is like hasn't read the rest of it, like some of the things it's like, oh, cool. Yeah, they have kids. We can talk about the kids and like I'll feel OK about that. But like, you know, this is a very specific like plot beat. So
all good.
And a big one. But nonetheless, a very cool moment. Very cool scene. Never thought I'd get to see it. One of those things. So. All right. We get to the moment we get the revival. We see Paul physically change. He is revived and he's completely different. There's this massive meeting of the Fremen in the south in which there are millions that pour in. There's this massive underground like temple complex that seems to be buried under a plateau that is just ridiculous and incredible. Paul in that moment asserts himself as a messiah of sorts, the Lisan al-Ghaib, but does it in a way that he doesn't claim it so much as he proves it by pointing at people and explaining their history and their lives in the sort of like deeper existence as they relate to the timeline. So curious on your guys' thoughts as both like representation and how it played out for y'all.
Well, he certainly knows how to carry himself. Like this is truly a really impressive performance by Timothy.
Yeah.
Thank you.
This is,
No, we don't call you Timothy. You hate that. You hate it. Don't look at me like that. Stop it.
It was like my favorite performance scene from him of anything I've seen him in.
Yeah.
Very.
Yeah, he
energetic.
Really makes you want to run into a wall, doesn't he?
A little bit.
This is for him. Jesus Christ. Like, yeah.
Lisa now, Gabe.
Dude. Yeah. That was really fucking cool. Yeah. I think, like, too, like, just is he actually, I don't know if he is in the book, but the gurney kind of just hanging out in the circle. It's just like, and then he like grabs Chaney and he's like, not a place. Like just like just chill for a little
he's
bit.
He's just like, yeah, dude.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even I know this is a religious moment.
Yeah, you can't. This is not the place to do this. But yeah.
I'm pretty sure he's not here in the book. I'm pretty sure he's hanging out with Jessica in this moment. But
I think the thing for me that I really liked about this scene, but I think it is more powerful in the book, is obviously like him pointing at people, giving them the history. But when they tell him he's not allowed to speak there, and then Stilgar's like, dude, kill me. Like, it's time. It's go time. Just nuke me. I really like how Paul rejects the idea of Fremen killing their best to take leadership. Like, in this time right now, I would not strike you down and kill you, which this comes
why
up
would I break
earlier.
My best blade?
Right. Yeah. This comes up earlier in the siege. When he's like, hey, this is the best time to kill me or whatever. But this is like the finality of that, like, as your leader, or like, I am the best of you. I am in charge. And this is one thing that I can't take, is that I would get rid of you, Stilgar, and like everyone else. And it's like, we're fighting them. We need all of us. So like, I don't know. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, I loved it. I mean, it obviously, like, there's a point of this in the back half that we have to like preface with, this is the danger of following a messiah figure, and that's the whole point of the story. If you didn't catch that, you missed the point of the story. That's sort of the whole point.
I missed it.
But that said, in the moment that he takes the water of life, he shifts into a completely different character. And this sub character that we get in this moment, where he is this grandiloquent speaker of whom can also like basically lean down and speak directly to someone's eyes and bear their soul out to witness for everyone else, is magnificent.
This was a pretty stark transformation of character, and this brings in what I was talking about earlier, his promise to Chani of like loving her until his last breath. Like, I really thought that was done now. I really believed that that promise had been fulfilled.
Yeah, I don't see There's it. That, I don't movie. See it that way, because it is, and I know we've been over this, but it is like the Paul says, like, yeah, like, I'll love you forever. And then it's really like what Crossan's saying about like, well, she's the one that has like the more conditional love, which is like, well, yeah, well, you might, but
you're not you anymore.
Yeah, I might be fucking out, dude. Which, yeah.
Yeah, this whole speech moment is so wonderful. We get the Fremen on the side. We dissuade Stilgar from the duel, which is sort of this moment in which he like pulls out the knife and he's like, just kill me. And then you can take the seat. We get the moment kind of on the mount in which he convinces everyone. They all agree. We then get a grand plan session of what's going to happen. This assault is the Emperor has arrived. And the Emperor's arrival is pretty fucking badass.
Giant ball from space. We like
it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But like from a cinematography perspective, and like obviously CGI, you see this mirror ball roll out over the landscape. And the way that it rolls on the mirror is perfect to the way that the landscape's depicted. And you know that's all CGI, and it's all brilliantly done.
I think they did it for real. It's like the thing with the Apollo, where there's
maybe they might have done it. They might have done it with a drone.
Yeah, you know, we're just going to find spice.
True, true, true. Literally cheaper to go to the moon.
I was curious if we were going to get an understanding or a reasoning behind the shroud of fire on the ship.
Shroud of fire. Are you talking about on descent stage or before the sandstorm?
No, while it's stationary.
While the sandstorm
that's
is there.
The sandstorm. So it's little sand particles being dusted by, and it's like basically like bleeding off the shield.
That makes sense. Okay.
Yeah, I thought you were gonna say is I was wondering if they would have an explanation for why his ship is a giant ball. And because somebody that I watched the movie with was like, it doesn't, like, this movie's pretty grounded in sci-fi. Like, I can believe the ornithopters are dragonflies, but I don't understand why his ship is a ball. And I just looked at them and I was like, listen, it's a ball because he's got like fuck you money because he's the Emperor, and like inefficient forms of travel is like what emperors do. So that's why it's a ball.
Yeah. I don't ride in a palanquin because it's convenient and efficient. I ride in a palanquin to show force because I need six people to lift me up and parade me everywhere I go. You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Totally the case. And I feel like that's pretty similar, especially considering he pours out a palace out of the insides as it pours itself out. Yeah. So we have this complicated plan that happens with one of the, again, coolest, largest action sequences of all time as it plays out. We get wonderful flashbacks to the memories and visions that we saw from part one play out physically on display in front of us as the Atomics open up the safe crater for three and many more sandworms to follow. But one giant one that in IMAX, oh my God, it looks like it's going to swallow you whole as it bears down from the top of the screen to swallow up the Sardaukar. There's also the eruption of all of the different rocks landing, and then they crawl themselves out to just get eaten by worms. It's so cool as the army is hit from all sides. We then also see the death of the Baron, challenging of the Emperor to the duel. There's so much here to talk about as we approach the end of this sort of sequence. So I kind of want to talk about everything from the initiating moment through the beginning of the duel, if that makes sense. Like, let's tackle that. What a battle sequence, right? Like, I mean, how
much
do
better
you,
than two sentences.
How do you do Helm's Deep again?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, no, it was really good. Leading off with the Atomics, and then, you know, we were just talking about Oppenheimer. But guess what? Atomics look way cooler with CGI than without. This movie looked like made that be a lot more powerful. Like, so my theme for the first part was to shit on Star Wars, but I think my theme for this one's to shit on Oppenheimer, even though I really enjoyed that movie. I can
Oppenheimer is also my top 10 for the record. It's number 9.
I can see why good old HZ decided to write the music for this movie and not Oppenheimer, but that's neither here nor there. Yeah, the blast off with the Atomics, having the fanatic. Oh my God, when Paul like walks over the cliff and you see just like the flood of bodies, and it's like, wow, he's gonna be hanging out with the fanatics, okay? And there's not like 10, there's a lot,
millions.
And then Chaney getting her cool
that
armor.
Slow walk up, and then the sword in the air, the knife in the air, the Chris knife. Oh man,
Chaney getting her cool armor with the Fedaiken, that was pretty sick. And then like Gurney is gonna be doing like a Gurney do. It's really good. Yeah.
Gurney do military moves.
I liked how after the Sardaukar got nuked, they were still trying to keep up appearances and have their flags going. That was cool. The Sardaukar with long swords was pretty cool, even though that feels probably more ceremonial than actually like fighting. Yeah, it was really cool. I don't know, somebody else say what you think. Trying to grab bag on things that I think are
so
really cool.
Good. I appreciate your feelings on the display of the nukes. I feel like it could have been portrayed very similarly, but in a way that made it feel more like a nuclear explosion as opposed to a conventional explosion.
Well, I think the thing here is that I don't know if they say what the warheads are actually on them, but because these aren't like ICBMs and they're not like doing like a MIRV launch system, they're basically just like a, to me, those are just tactical nukes. So they're like low yield payloads that like you use for an offensive deployment. And those actually don't look that like, they don't look like the Tsar Bomba or Hiroshima. They do, but they also don't.
I think even just like a split second shock of like just a wash of bright white dimming into the like the falling of the shrapnel and the mountain like raining on the Sardaukar. I feel like something like that would have portrayed that we knew they were nukes. So like this is a dumb thing to be arguing anyway, but I don't know. It felt
not lackluster to you.
They felt not nukey. Yeah.
That's so interesting because they nuked a fucking mountain with three of them and turned it into like a Vesuvius basically, which is where it blows my mind because it's like that is so much more than a nuke. But I do understand the bright light flash. Like, that's maybe the one thing that I can get you on, is like, do a blind and then pull back and then show the destruction.
But also have the nukes come from the other side of the mountain range, so the shrapnel actually goes instead, like the way it goes over the armies and then hits the mountain range, which would send the shrapnel primarily away.
Would it?
Mostly.
It kind of like landed on the top. It was kind of like down in. Yeah. But the point being, like, that's why I compare it to like a volcano, because I imagine it's more of like a circular realm of destruction as opposed to something targeted, which if you were going from the other way, it would do that. Your point.
This is the dumbest, stupidest, like littlest thing that, like,
again, perfect movie. We're talking about like the smallest little shit in a perfect movie. Yeah. Right. And that's what you do in perfect movies. So. Yeah. I like it. I don't mind. I don't mind the nuke. I love the fucking worm showing up. The worm that's just big. And you see from the starter car's perspective, he goes, oh, fuck. And then they turn around and like, these are the scariest motherfuckers that are painting themselves with thousands of men's blood to like authenticate themselves as warriors that have basically fought through a Spartan-esque program, as we assume in sort of that like Greco-Roman fashion. And they're just terrified of giant space worm do. So it's pretty fun. The Fremen fight as well. When they come out of the sand, we've seen this a couple of times, but specifically like seeing it all play out very well in the way that they execute. And the Fremen again, just fight like demons and destroy the Sardaukar is also very satisfying. As even the Emperor's best trained men are fucking nothing. And this is all of them.
A lot of people.
Yeah. It's a lot of people.
I don't have a ton to say about it. It's just like really good eye candy. Like, cause this is also something that like, there's not a lot to draw on. This is a big battle. It has like these three pronged attacks. Here we go. Oh, I would say here is what, with how we're pacing this, we're not talking about like the final part, but the, I think my favorite fight scene, and there weren't too many, but from part one is like the part where Arakeen is like under attack at night. And you see like the ornithopters that are kind of like, there are elements of like Black Hawk Down that are kind of like Denny Villeneuve like pulled for that.
It's like clearly flying around and swooping.
Right. Yeah. The way he does this in this movie at night, and then that like shotgun Gatling feeling that it has, it feels a lot like those things in Wolfenstein. Just like clipping the crowds of Fremen as they're like charging. And then, when Gurney finally makes it to Rabban, that's cool, because if I recall correctly, that's not at all what happens, right?
It is not. Yeah. So there's no, this is perhaps my favorite edition of the entire story, is giving Gurney his like payoff moment.
Yeah.
Because I also, just from like a sequel perspective, I still don't think that he quite gets the same sort of like payoff that he does here to like kill Rabban, and Rabban being built up in this way makes sense. This entire scene with Gurney, I like more than I like all the subsequent battle stuff that I talked about. Him charging up and cutting through those dudes in the way that we see the fight from the ground perspective, the bodies flashing in front, and right behind him is an Atreides flag bearer the whole fucking time. You can watch him in the entire shot. It consumed me in this rewatch today as I was watching it. And you just see the same guy striding behind him, and he kind of gets shocked as some of the bodies are flying by him as his like head turns, as Gurney is just cleaving through people, and they're the only two. They make it through the line. Everyone else is continuing to fight, and he just trudges up the fucking stairs. There's like three other people that arrive with him as they've carved their way out, and you see Gurney just go for the fucking throat on Rabban as Rabban turns around to face him, because like, ah, fucking you. You know me. Yeah, I gave you the scar. Time to end this. And gets him through the throat so he can't say another word, because it's nothing but shit and lies. What a moment. This story did Gurney Halleck right. And that's something that I feel less confident about when I speak about the books.
Yeah.
100%. Gurney Halleck is a very different place. But yeah.
Okay. I believe it.
Yeah.
I liked Zark here.
Yeah, it's good. It's not over either, but like in particular, this payoff was necessary, I think, and was deserved on all accounts. Cool. All right. So we get into the actual fortification of the Emperor inside of his sort of like throne of sorts that he keeps with him as he travels around in his sort of world ship away from Corin. But he takes it here. He lands. He builds this little temple. We get the siege, of which is pitch perfect to the way that it's described in the book. You see the walls shake. You hear them shake. It's in this 3D space. The two doors split open. A tiny figure that's unassuming walks in. You don't really know what it is, but we know that it's Mahdib. You know, it's Lisa Malgaib. We know that it's Paul Atreides here to claim what's rightfully his. He strides up that throne immediately before even unveiling himself, speaks to his grandfather, kills his grandfather, buries the knife. And yeah, this is PJ, one of the biggest departures from the book.
Who do you think kills Baron Harkonnen in the book?
Baron.
You've already mentioned it.
Oh, did we? Okay.
Did we?
Yeah, you did.
The toddler.
Yeah. The toddler. Yep. And then it haunts her, which is crazy. But I don't know how that's going to happen.
Right.
Yeah. I don't mind the change. I know that people are pretty out on the change because of the way that it potentially impacts the character. But I don't think it changes literally anything because of the genetic memory component. I think it has nothing to do with anything that people are talking about. So.
Well, and she's the one that told Paul, so fine. Or she told Jessica, yeah, Jessica exactly. Told Paul, whatever.
Right. Yeah, because Jessica didn't know, but the baby knew because of the genetic memory. So the only reason that we know that Paul and Jessica are Harkonnen is because of little Aaliyah.
But Paul knew himself independently.
Oh, yeah. Wait, hang on. Yeah, isn't the book... You find out that, wait, I'm confused, but yeah, sure, whatever.
Hang on.
Yeah. It's in the movie, Paul's the one who figures out their Harkonnens.
They both do, independently.
Well, no, yeah, he knows because he sees the future, and he unwinds it.
Oh, and then and then she's like, oh yeah, we do that. Yep. Yeah, me and the feet. Yeah,
but Jessica is the only one left out of the circle, toss, basically.
We've been talking, yeah.
Yeah. We both see the future. Well, she sees the past. I see the future. You're stuck in the present, Mom. Yeah. Still, nonetheless, what a crazy sort of like moment, killing your grandfather. Grandfather killed your dad. / his son-in-law.
It's a messy family reunion.
A bloody one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The complications of Messiah make me... So, like, the interbreeding that the Bene Gesserit require, and this is such a side tangent, I'm not going to talk about it. Tim knows what I'm thinking about, but, like, the complications therein are wide-reaching. But Baron dies, deservedly. Mr. Floaty Boy, after getting cut down by the Sardaukar and falling and then kind of crawling his way towards the throne.
As if that's going to be anything.
What a moment. Yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
As though like your moment on the throne as you're crawling for it is like your shit, piss and air are leaking out of your tubes because you can't manage it yourself anymore. God, what a dude. Stellan Skarsgård, despicably lovely in the role. So from there we move to them going to the final chapter of the book. In the final chapter of the book mirrors almost the final chapter of the story here. It's pretty close, and I particularly appreciate the choice to keep it this way. There really isn't a whole lot that extends on either side of the story, but there is the final confrontation with the Emperor and sort of the rights to ascension. The great houses show up, of course, as they've been challenged to do so in the moment. And there is a fucking incredible sword duel here. Dagger duel, rather, between Bade, of whom steps in as the Emperor's champion, and Paul, killing his cousin, that is just pitch perfect.
I think wonderful. The fact that this movie has such an amazing score makes the fact that this fight being scoreless entirely so much more powerful.
it's just grunts and like contact and noises. It's just the fight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's
no
bold.
Moment.
That,
nothing
that
else.
Is, that's risky. That's bold. That's amazing. And it is pulled off so well.
Dude, and my sphincter tent was so tight during that. Like, it's a tense, it's a tense scene, dude.
That's a tight butthole.
I kept waiting for the knee knife to come out, and I'm glad it didn't, because good God.
Yeah, yeah, that would have been a thing to try to explain earlier. But I think the way that it plays out is great for a number of reasons. One that I personally appreciate is obviously Paul's omniscient and can see these things, and so sees the inevitable path towards the future. And so as such is walking that, but also in the way that it's paralleled in part one, in the sort of way that Gurney and him face off, and it's like this trading of wounds, and he's like, well, I got you. And it's like, well, I would have gotten you as well. It's like, well, does it matter if I won? And so there's this nice parallel there between that first practice duel that we see at the very beginning and this final moment. So it's a nice culmination of the training there that I really appreciate. Those are 2 points. I'll think of the other one in a moment here. I'll resume the thought. But those are like, those are some of the high level things that I really enjoy beyond what we've mentioned.
I quite liked, we skipped past this, but I liked Paul shouting at the Reverend Mother, and then the cut to Jessica just being like, yeah, that's my kid. Like, what's up? You know, the mm-hmm. like eyes she gives. Yeah, yeah, that's great.
The voice, his yeah. use of the voice
yeah,
against the Reverend
her,
Mother.
Does he tell her to
like,
be
quiet?
Yeah. Yeah. And then yeah. she's like, you mm-hmm. can't do that to me. And then like, oh,
whoa. Yeah.
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 Yeah. That's cool.
So during this fight, Fade directly interacts with Chaney. And that does, that feels like yeah. something that could have paid off better. Or could have led to something more powerful. But it in the way that it was left,
I feel like it's
a
threat.
It's a threat.
I don't know.
Yeah, but
so here's what that did for me is like when he kept looking at her, and then also too when like Fade was like they are now at odds with each other. Like he's like got that thing where he's like, you know, I'll always love you, whatever. It's conditional for her, whatever we want to say here. The it's like he keeps looking at her to see if she's feeling. Or like what she's feeling. And then also like he sees the way, but she doesn't. Does she see or like what does her not knowing? What would her emotion be? Because he like knows kind of what the outcome's going to be, basically. Right. So I thought it was like really powerful. And every time it like cut to her, too, I'm like, dude, I've read a couple of these books. I thought Paul was going to like or no, I didn't think so, but I almost thought he was going to die a couple times. Like I was like, is Denny just going to drop the mic and be like, I'm making two and I'm changing it? Like, I thought that was a possibility in that fight. So I like that they cut to
which
her,
is crazy.
But I have a different yeah. perspective on what they did with the cuts that I don't necessarily think is a book thing, but it is like it's like just how their dynamic is in this movie.
Yeah. Again. I am so impressed. And this movie reminds me of sort of like a golden rule of sorts, I think. It's not that folks resent the idea of adapting things innately. They just want them done well and like consistently. I think that's the most important thing, is being consistent in some way. Like Chani is very different, but it is logically consistent with the through line of the story in the end. And so that's okay to have changed the character fundamentally in the ways that it is to make that like work out, you know, in the end. So, yeah, just as like a long sort of long view thing here, as we've the original content that we talked about was like comparing this to like an eventual Red Rising adaptation. And for me, with something like that, all that I want is the through line of Darrow to be incredibly consistent and like the friends to mostly be there in the way that they should be. Do I need beat for beat accuracy? No. Would I love some of those moments? Yeah. Should we pay like high reverence to like cultural things that are relevant? Yeah. You know, but like, do I need obsidians to be 12 feet tall?
Yes.
Yeah.
I would like that. But like, can it happen?
No.
They need to have all the fingers and be the height, or I will be upset. But
that's fine. Have disparate finger count, but yeah, that's
better not be an actor shorter than me playing any Gold.
Right. Yeah, that's a standard rule. Yeah. Besides Sevro. Sevro can be a normal human. Anyway.
Should the Emperor, or okay, I kind of wish this would happen, but I'm ultimately glad it didn't. I was kind of hoping Paul would shout at the Emperor to kneel. Mm. Is there anything that like that sticks out to you as like a because I'm glad he obviously didn't shout at Fade. Didn't. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
I like that to the Emperor point, I like that he didn't, because I liked the sort of like gradual moment of like kissing and bending to the ring, especially given all the context.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, his decision, and then all of the context from the first part of the story of like the number of lives that have gone before you holding this ring and sort of the weight of it, you know, who are you impressing, and who are you sort of fighting to represent? Can you do better than them? Like, there's a wonderful thought piece to be driven from the, like a YouTube essay from the words that Leto says in that initial scene in the graveyard to the entirety of the story, because it is better than it was ever portrayed in the book. Yeah. And it is well rendered through the movie.
Yeah, I liked that it was Paul's actions and not his demands that compelled the Emperor to submit in the way that he did. Like, I don't think using the voice in general would have been the right way to go about it.
Right.
But even like verbally commanding something would have taken away from the actions that, maybe not taken away from it, but his actions are more powerful in that they speak for themselves.
Yeah. I'm not sure that the voice is impressive to folks outside of people of whom know how to use the voice. So like the voice almost isn't like it's a tool to be used in whatever circumstance, but like it's only impressive to those of whom are the Bene Gesserit or otherwise. Like, who's going to remark upon you like making the Emperor bow with your voice, like the Reverend Mother and your mom? Like,
yeah, and his use of force against Helen Moheim was good enough, right? Like the to tell her to be quiet is basically the same type of flex of killing Fade and whatnot.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the same type of power wielded
using one's power against themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also making them like intentionally deprive themselves of that power, like being willing to like, you know, step back from it one way or another is wild. So getting to the end of this, the Emperor, of course, submits to Paul. Paul, as a part of this, even before the duel, proposes a marriage to the Empress as to keep the houses together and keep the empire together and like lead to his ascension to the throne. Johnny is immediately heartbroken, it seems, by this. At the end of the duel, she storms out and rides off into the sunset on Sandworm back. DJ wrote in my script for me.
I had to. Sandworm back.
Yeah.
As a single word.
Yeah. I'm very curious on, obviously, lots of thoughts around the end of this. I have even, we'll talk a little bit about like the book ending versus this. Curious on what we think. Obviously, beyond this also is the great houses don't accept this, and it's going to lead to the holy war that Paul was trying to avoid but was ultimately inevitable the moment that he went south. This is the end.
I felt like it was pretty clear that Johnny was heartbroken. It seems that way, but it felt pretty solidly.
I'm curious what Messiah is going to look like if they make that, right? Because she's obviously an important figure in that. I wonder if it's going to start with the whole like episode 8 Star Wars, go find Jedi Janey and find her and bring her back and whatever. But I have no idea how they go into Messiah with how this movie ends. The last part, Crossan mentioned it already, quoted to me once about the like the concubine and like the power that she has. I still feel like that it kind of is more like a
I don't know if she really had a choice in that moment in the book with how it is kind of presented. And I guess glad she's given one here.
I don't think it's meant to be presented as a choice necessarily, but like an inevitability.
Seizing the power within it, I guess.
It's a reality.
Yeah.
Yeah. The final lines of the novel are from Jessica. A bitter laugh escaped Jessica. Think on it, Chani. That princess will have the name, yet she'll live as less than a concubine, never to know a moment of tenderness from a man to whom she's bound. While we, Chani, we who carry the name of concubine, history will call us wives. This is accurate over time. This is the way that a lot of things go, where it's like all the children came from whatever XYZ, often referred to as the actual wife, even though they may have been married in political reasons to other people. It's entirely correct. And so there's power to be wielded there. But this is the biggest gap here. What I caught this time around is that after waking up from the, was it before or after? Right around the Water of Life.
Yeah.
Jessica. It's after the Water of Life, because he's sitting in the ring. Sitting in the ring talking with Jessica. He says, she'll come around. And that's what makes me go, yeah, okay. So we're going to see like a time cut where like eventually within the story, she'll come around to the idea, or he'll convince her as a part of it, because she is critical to the story of Messiah.
But did the movie ever actually kind of like lay out that quote to her? Like, there's the one thing where Jessica's like, oh, by the way, you know, like when she's like packing her stuff and they have like an intimate moment, I guess, between Chani and Jessica, she's kind of like, Jessica's trying to like have her not leave or whatever's going on. And that's like the closest we get to Chani knowing what the plan actually is, which I kind of, yeah, it's kind of tricky.
That's their only actual like direct interaction as far as I can recall.
For the most part, yeah, they're like shared conversations. So there's no like extensive plan, but it's when Paul is sitting on the ring of like the sandworm, basically, right where basically he woke up, and that's where he has the moment with Jessica, where he says that. Then afterwards, we move into the scene that you're talking about. Okay. So like he sees an inevitability. She feels like she needs to intervene.
I see.
Because he can see the path. So I don't think it's going to interfere with Messiah at all. I think she's, you know, this is like writerly reductive, and I'm very curious to see how Denny actually handles it. But right now, it seems like the way that the text is pitching it is like she's throwing a fit because things didn't like fully go her way and like everything else, and a reasonable fit. Like, this is not, you know, unbespoke. This is like, you know, your fiance all of a sudden being like, oh yeah, I'm going to go marry that other person in the 11th hour in Vegas, basically.
Yeah.
For political reasons and trying to make that make sense. So, yeah, I totally understood. But I think that it is like an inevitable kind of come around. I would think that we will get this quote, this end quote, at some point in Messiah when Chani turns. And she will still be mad at Jessica, though. Like, it will be, as opposed to this being an affirming quote, which is what Jessica is doing here, it will be a sort of misanthropic moment in which Chani receives it and is like, I guess I'm fine with that. Yeah, it's a tough one. PJ has mentioned the story doesn't end here.
Well, that is literally the final.
In the same way in the book. That's it. History will call us wives is the end of the book.
Huh. Yeah. Well, clearly I haven't read this in like a couple of years. All right.
And again, you know, from meta-text perspective, people were mad when Frank ended it there. He never intended this to be a series initially. Like, he was like, this is enough. And people wrote into him enough about like, well, what happens? Like, this isn't the end, obviously. And he's like, well, you didn't catch the fucking point of the story. This is going to turn out bad. Do you want me to paint you the picture of what it looks like when it goes bad? And so that's what Messiah is.
Yeah, Messiah is basically a response text to people being like, Lisa no Kaib, Lisa no Kaib.
Yeah. He's like, all right, you didn't get the fucking message. So here it is.
It's kind of a testament to him as being a bad writer, right? Yeah. Like, you write 800 pages about how you shouldn't have a Messiah, and then you have to write a follow up.
That's not a bad writer. That's a bad audience. It's people's intelligence.
Yeah, I know.
Fun fact. I'm joking. Another bonus fun fact about Dune. he couldn't get it published by any major publisher.
He got it published by like a Tool catalog or something, right?
A fucking Tool catalog published him. And that's where the book was published originally, was by a Tool catalog. And they distributed him to the people of whom bought the fucking Tool catalog first.
That's so hilarious.
He started literally at like a lower band of population and then grew in infamy over time, which is no different than Paul, which is so funny. For a dude that is like focused on anthropology and like ecology and all of this, that's the way that the story sold, which is fascinating. So needless to say, again, I highly recommend everyone listens to the 1978 interview. That'll be a part of the show notes. Definitely go check that out. I am very curious. Do you guys have any other thoughts? PJ, I mean, like, where do you think the story goes? Tim, was there anything else that was standing out to you missing? Those are kind of the things left to address.
So my assumption is that we go off world based on everybody loading in and like taking off on seeming to take off on ships.
A galactic jihad.
Mm-hmm. But I don't know, man. I want to see it. I want to see it happen. I'm really excited to pick up these books. I've been meaning to since we recorded the first show about it, and I haven't, but
we will never cover this book series outside of this. And if we decide to do like a single book episode to talk about it with Tim, now that you're like caught up to speed, if that makes sense, mm-hmm. like we won't ever do it in the way that we do the show.
Okay,
you are welcome to read whatever you'd like.
I wasn't going to ask permission.
Well, I know, but you do sometimes. You're like, can I read that? And I'm like, of course you can. Yeah. There are a couple.
But you know, to be here for like a fly on the wall for this.
Yeah.
Mom and dad are fighting. Yeah, it's great.
It's not really fighting, but it is.
Fuck you.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah, no. Not fuck you, fuck PJ. But yeah.
All right. Well, I guess I think of my opening opinion, and I guess I'll kind of reiterate some of it here, which is like, I don't think there has been a better adaptation, and this is probably the best movie I've ever seen. It is not my favorite movie, but like as a movie, this is incredible. I mm-hmm. really hope that like we do see a Messiah. I did not know that there was supposedly a show until today. Hopefully that's good. But also I kind of hope for some scarcity.
Miniseries. But yeah.
Okay, miniseries, even better. Yeah. I'm hoping for some scarcity in wherever they take things from here, because I don't want to be like a spin out into a cinematic universe for Dune and just like water it down. I don't want that. I really, really like this movie, this book, books. That's really all I got. It's great. Yeah. Happy to be here.
Yeah. Just as like a co-pitch on that, agreed. I hope that they don't like take the wrong lesson from this, which is that people want more Dune. The answer is not people want more Dune. The answer is people want more deep, intentional, passionate content, or like a passionate movie or story. And that's what creators should be focusing on in some way, shape, or form. So takeaway isn't necessarily more Dune. It's like more intentional sci-fi. It's more intentional epics. It's more, you know, it's more of that than anything else. That said, I am excited for Prophecy. There's nothing else in the pipeline for the series in general. I think it'll be interesting to see. I think it's removed enough where it won't impact it. And similar to The Hobbit, like, I don't look back on the Lord of the Rings movies worse because of The Hobbit. And I will feel very similarly about this Prophecy show on the whole, because Villeneuve's access or like influence is more of a producer role than it is anything else. So like he's helping and gave like a lot of guidance. But other than that, you know, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And I can be okay with that. It will not impact my opinion on Messiah or anything else.
Let's just hope our generation's
perfect movie.
Yeah. Let's just hope our generation's Ridley Scott doesn't have another Race by Wolves True. On their hand. Yeah.
Oh, don't do that to me. It's too early in his career. Also, he was only a producer. But yeah. Yeah. Through that on the Ridley Scott note. Yeah, I am so excited for the eventual Messiah. This is a wonderful movie. If you haven't seen it, The Eventual Messiah. Yeah, I can't wait for Lisan Al-Ghaib to show up in real life. I need a leader personally. But yeah, I love it. The only other note that we didn't hit on here that I wanted to bring up from my notes from part one is that Stilgar has this line that he says where he says, "I judge too hastily," right off the bat. That's one of the earliest things that he says to any of the characters. And that's interesting as it plays into the council and everything else down the line. But just want to bring that up as like another cross-textual examination of the character. It was always there. Just to have the cultural context. Cool. PJ, I need a bullshitty, crazy prediction for Messiah. Where is this going? We haven't told you everything. Or most things.
Aaliyah?
Yep.
Not a part of it.
That's crazy. I need a second one.
Can you try again?
No, we'll take the first one, but I can't wait for you to drink on that one. You mean this whole character that we've been building up as a fetus for a whole fucking movie? We're just going to ignore that. Okay, cool.
We even have an actor.
Yeah, we have an actress associated with them. Like, what are we doing?
Let's see.
What a baller movie.
Literally
that would
anything,
be,
buddy. Yeah. I mean, yeah, power pro play considering the story. We don't want to do children, so we're cutting Aaliyah. Anyway. Right,
whatever the ridiculous things can I claim? But we end up on Earth. Like our Earth.
All right, full Brian Herbert. Okay, sounds good. Nice. Full red dope. Well, thank you for your input. We will consider this in our evaluation. Tim, did you have any final thoughts that you want to levy on the audience for the first time in many years? Good. What a powerful move. All right, sweet. Well, again, thank you so much to everyone who's bared with us up until this point. This is a long episode, but we love talking about Dune. We love talking about a little bit about Red Rising, and this has been a fun time, and people loved this the first time we did it, so we're happy to return. Tim, thank you for coming back for this. Thanks, and for Tim. Doing everything you do for the fucking show, by the way.
I thank you every episode, but I'm thanking you in person now.
Oh, that's nice.
You don't hear but there are 200 episodes of thanks. Plus. Yeah, this episode is 198, which is nuts. It still blows my mind. So,
and 199 maybe, depending on if we can put this out.
Yeah, we might. I mean, depending. Yeah, we might actually have exceeded the size of an episode with the audio length, which is always a gambit with some of these longer episodes. Man, I haven't said gambit in a while. Yeah.
All right, we got to get out of here. Come on. Yeah, take us home.
We got to leave. We got to ditch. All right. So thank you guys again so much for supporting the show. You can check us out wordsandwhiskey.show, and you can check out all of the show links within the links here immediately in the podcast. Otherwise, you can see them there. And you can support us at patreon.com/wordsandwhiskey. Check us out on social media at wordswhiskeypod on just about everything you could imagine, anywhere and everywhere all at once.
Where can you find all the links?
You can find the links on the website or in the show notes. But if you can't find the links, you can go to wordsandwhiskey.show/links, and I'll give you the links like a hole in the head. PJ, what's going to happen to people if they don't review us for 5 stars?
Lisan Al-Ghaib.
Lisan Al-Ghaib what?
Well, duel you and win.
I entrust you with so much responsibility. Sorry, so little responsibility. <I'm just kidding. laughs> All I ask is for a threat each week. But thank you again so much for listening. Thanks, of course, to Andrew and to Tim, of whom are omnipresent in all the shows and do so much work for us to make sure that this stays on, our lights stay on, and that we sound good to begin with. So thank you all, and we will see you next week with the first episode of Before They Were Hanged. And then after that, it's our 200th episode, so it's going to be something crazy. I don't know what the fuck that is. We'll figure that out. Okay, cool. See you then.
Bye.
Bye. Give me a say bye.
Bye.